Welcome to this week's edition of Third Opinion. Lots of news to talk about, and you're going to hear about some Israeli companies who helped put on the Super Bowl. A reminder, please subscribe to the Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you are listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Since we have talked last, the Bucks won the Super Bowl. I mean, it doesn't get much more exciting than that. What do you think, Lorene?
We're world renowned in Tampa Bay now. So exciting. And I know, so later on today, we've got a clip we're going to play. The Israeli consulate did a webinar with several Israeli companies, also some of which are associated with our very own Florida Israel Business Accelerator here in Tampa, that were involved behind the scenes with this whole production for the Super Bowl. So very excited about that, and we'll be bringing that to you today as well. But yeah, I mean, I think, and hopefully we'll get that interview in the near future with our Bucks player.
Ali Marpet, who was the guard who created the hole for Fournette to run through to make the touchdown. He was a pulling guard. He blocked the guy, created the hole, and he's a terrific player. And they all give Ali Marpet a lot of credit. So, yeah, hopefully we'll be able to do that because he is Jewish and does embrace his Judaism. No, but speaking of Jewish, I mean, obviously the thing that has been going on all this week was the impeachment trial. And two very prominent Jewish people were involved. Jamie Raskin, who is the lead House manager for the House against the president, and then David Schoen, who is one of the defense lawyers for former President Trump. And quite frankly, I was distressed. You know, everybody talked about Schoen putting his hand over his head when he drank some water because Orthodox Jews, and he is an Orthodox Jew, say a blessing before they do anything. I mean, other than breathing, although when you wake up, you say a bracha as well. But here's what distressed me, Lorene, is Schoen didn't feel comfortable wearing a yarmulke in the Senate chamber because he thought it would make him stand out and be different.
I agree with that. I don't think that he was wrong in that. I think that there is... Look, we know that there's anti-Semitism in this country, and I think he also didn't want people who were watching it be like, oh, look at that Jew defending the president. I mean, there are, as we know, people who hate Jews on both sides of the aisle that are extreme, right?
Right.
I get it. Like, he didn't want his defense, which I thought he was a brilliant lawyer, brilliant presentation. I get it. He didn't want
to. I thought he was terrible.
I gave him the A+. And I think the whole impeachment was an abomination. I think it's a disgrace to this country.
Lorene, you are crazy. The president, did you listen to Mitch McConnell yesterday? Did you listen to Mitch McConnell afterwards, who said the president was involved? The president was he is responsible, but he didn't think it was constitutional, even though the Senate said it was constitutional. They are the ultimate authority until the Supreme Court. The president is lucky that he wasn't convicted. It was not an abomination, and most of America disagrees with you on that.
Let me just finish my statement. I think most actual, true, genuine constitutional lawyers agree with me.
No, they do not, Lorene. There is a raft of constitutional lawyers that say this was constitutional, and the Senate is the final arbiter, and they voted that it was constitutional. So it is constitutional. Unless the Supreme Court comes in, that is completely constitutional. That's the way our system works, and that's what they did, and it is constitutional now.
I now complete my statement because you keep talking over me, and I know we've got this feedback. So let me just finish what I was saying. I agree with Alan Dershowitz, who is probably the foremost scholar on constitutional.
Oh, no, he's nuts. Alan Dershowitz is nuts. He's lost it. He was losing it on Newsmax. He is not the foremost scholar. Jamie Raskin is a teacher. He is a law professor as well at George Washington University. So Dershowitz is not the ultimate authority.
I'm sorry, but I can't finish my comment because you keep talking over me. And
okay.
I don't know.
Okay, go ahead. I'll be quiet.
No one else in the United States of America that's alive today that is a constitutional lawyer who has literally an amicus professor at Harvard Law School, who has argued most of the First Amendment cases, has no other person. He is by far the number one spokesperson on the First Amendment in the Constitution. Number two, what they did was an abomination because the House manager said the First Amendment does not apply to a private citizen. Let me tell you something. That is a first time thing.
Wait a second. He didn't say the First Amendment doesn't apply to a private citizen. They said you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, in essence.
Mike, they said the First Amendment doesn't apply to a first to a private citizen. So what that means is, let's say you, Mike, decide to run for governor one day, but somebody on the other side of the party that was in control didn't like you. They could try to censor you before you even run. This is an
abomination. Lorraine, you're taking it out of context. Listen, lawyers from the Federalist Society, which is the conservative society to the liberal end, all said that this is constitutional. Dershowitz is not. Dershowitz is an idiot. He's lost it all. He was losing it on Newsmax. He could be indicted because of problems with the Jeffrey Epstein thing. Dershowitz is an 82-year-old man, and I'm not trying to be age discriminatory because I'm old too. He has lost it. He has lost it. He is not the foremost constitutional lawyer these days.
I disagree with you. We're going to disagree strongly because he is, because the Raskin was dead wrong. And the other professors who did it would say 100% reverse if it was politically on a different side. And what they started was a very dangerous thing. And they're saying that the Constitution doesn't apply to private citizens. The First Amendment applies.
You don't know what you're talking about, Lorraine. You're wrong. You're absolutely dead wrong. But let's move. Let's not get stuck. But here's one thing I think is important. Let's talk about Sean let's not talk about the trial and the Judaism. If you're an Orthodox Jew and you are going to wear a skull cap, a yarmulke all the time, I don't think you should be embarrassed to wear it anywhere. If you are going to embrace Orthodox Judaism, I don't wear a skull cap, obviously, when I'm not in temple. Sometimes in our temple, I don't even wear a skull cap. But if you are going to do it, because you can't be afraid to be different. I mean, a perfect example is, let's take our show. We are different. We are certainly not in step with the majority of the people who listen to WMNF. But that's okay. That's good. It should not be a monolithic, in my mind, radio station. We should be different. And people get upset because we're different. Well, same thing with Sean. He should have worn the yarmulke, I believe.
I get it, because he did not want what he was doing to distract from his message. And I thought his message was powerful. And again, it goes to, if that's the case, by the way, going back to the First Amendment, every single one of those lawmakers who made radical, ridiculous statements about fighting, they too could be.
That was the stupidest argument. Let's not get to hung. We could spend the whole show going on that. But listen, if you just listen to Mitch McConnell after the vote was taken yesterday, and that says it all. But that's beside the point. Let's not get hung up on that, because we could spend the whole show, and I'd be more than happy to do it. But I'm not sure our listeners want to listen to the whole show of that. So let's move on to other things.
McConnell's an expert on the Constitution. I will not take his word. What I'm talking about are people who actually have argued before the Supreme Court multiple times on First Amendment, very dramatic, very important First Amendment decisions in this nation, which Dershowitz has.
And so he's an idiot. He's lost it. He has lost it. He's an idiot. He's a partisan fool, in my estimation.
Not a partisan fool. He voted for Biden. But the one thing he does, and he has always done, is he will stand for constitutional principles regardless of who he's supporting. It doesn't matter. It's about the Constitution and the longer-term detriment. And this goes back to what we talked about last week with that wacko congresswoman from California who, she's crazy, but you know what? Her constituents, knowing she was crazy, chose her to be the representative.
No, you're talking about Atlanta. You're the Georgia congressman, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Georgia, yeah, where she's from. Like, the point being is that her constituents chose her. That's democracy, you know, and to censor somebody by a political party in power, that's the first time it's ever happened in our nation's history. Very dangerous. We see censorship happening. By the way, I found myself in very odd bedfellows this week, because, you know, I get countless emails every day by the Democratic Party. And I actually got multiple emails this week supposedly from Rashid Tlaib, you know, expressing her great concern about what's going on in this country with censorship, recognizing that censorship historically has been used against minorities. Look, we know Nazi Germany used it. We know any authoritarian dictatorship uses censorship, which, you know, kind of like what Twitter's doing right now, to silence any viewpoint that is contrary to theirs.
Wait, but do you think Twitter should be censoring the people who are posting that Jews and Israel should be decimated and taken off the face of the earth?
Well, I think that's a this is the question. They're not. Like, they're like, even the
latest. No, they're not doing that. But do you think that they should?
I think it, you know, I don't know, Mike. I don't know at this point, because the problem is this, is that we in America believe in free speech, even if we don't agree with it.
And I do too. The First Amendment, but it's not a First Amendment issue on Twitter. Twitter's a private company. Twitter can kick me off anytime it wants just because they say I don't like Mike Deason or Mike Deason's an idiot, which a lot of people will agree to. They have the right to do that. They are a private company. So,
but it's almost like the days of when AT&T pretty much controlled all the telecommunications, right? And it becomes almost like a quasi-government body, because it is the foremost and the primary source of communication. So the question then becomes, you know, which, by the way, I think there will be some Sherman Act, I do think there'll be antitrust investigations against them, because this is a problem, right? I mean, but Twitter is one example, but people are talking about this. People on both sides of the aisle are starting to have conversations about this censorship, because that's what happens when, you know, in extremism, like they want, let's censor and silence.
But do you want someone to have a forum that says Jews and Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth? Do you think that's appropriate to be on Twitter or Facebook?
I don't think it's appropriate, period, but I can't tell them not. If that's your viewpoint, then let's have a conversation about it. At least, by the way, and this is what I would say, Mike, there's something about knowing your enemy. I want to know who my enemy is. If they're going to go out there and make that point, at least I know where they stand. And now I can do what I need to do to push back against that and to re-educate. There's something about knowing your enemy and not censoring that dialogue.
But the problem, Laureen, is you're an intelligent woman. You're an attorney. There are so many people that read that stuff on Twitter or Facebook and take it as fact. And when they use anti-Semitic tropes, when they say that Jews are less than human, when they say Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth, there are people, many of whom were at the Capitol on January 6th, who believe that. So that is concerning to me, and I think concerning to at least Mark Zuckerberg in some relationship on Facebook.
Let me tell you something. Mark Zuckerberg and the CEO of Twitter, I'm not buying their BS. Let me just tell you something. They are being very, very selective in who they're banning from Twitter and Facebook and what they're shutting down and what they're not, to their political advantage.
Absolutely. I agree. But again, they're a private company.
Other people up. So it is, you know, so I think there's a severe problem. If we're going to say we're going to leave it to those people, I'd rather them not ban anyone, so that people who have opposing viewpoints can come out strong against them. Because if you're not going to ban the Ayatollah, then I should be able to be out there on Twitter and Facebook saying everything I can to controvert that and not worried about, oh, am I going to be banned from Twitter?
At this point, without the Sherman Antitrust Act being invoked, would you agree they are private companies and can censor anybody they want? You, me, whom?
I actually think under the law, this is because of which is what the ACLU said. There is a, and I know you and I don't agree on this, but because of it being a primary source of communication, and particularly political communication, that there's something about that control that goes beyond the bound. And so I think this is still a question that's yet to be decided in the courts. And I think it will depend very much upon what this administration does. So I don't know, but you know, I know that there, look, we've got to look, the AJC, the American Jewish Committee, has a whole platform that they send out videos to the Arab world, trying to re-educate, you know, and, you know, to the extent that the Arabs have been listening to all this other propaganda about Israel and Jews, and they get a lot of hits. Like, they're, you know, it's part of our responsibility to be out there and be a part of the dialogue. And I just, as much as I might hate the other side's speech, I'm very concerned about this, which is why I didn't want them to censor, you know, Congresswoman Omar. You know, I might not like her. I might not like a lot of the stuff that she says, but I don't want to censor her. You know, I'd rather have a public debate. And that's, you know, to me, I mean, look, Jews, two Jews, three opinions. We have public debates all the time. We don't have to agree on anything. But
the whole- we don't most of the time. Hey, listen, speaking of agreement and disagreement, we've got an election coming up. Not in this country, thank goodness. We still have a couple of years for that. But in Israel, and because of the Abraham Accords, Benny Netanyahu is trying to court some of the Arab members of the Knesset to come to him. And some are apparently turning toward Netanyahu, while on the other hand, others are saying that Netanyahu is just trying to use them. We have a little piece from Israeli TV that sort of gives us where things are going with the election right now. And let's take a listen to that. This is from Israeli TV, where the election stands and Netanyahu's hope of courting the Arab members of the Knesset.
Seizing opportunities presented in the aftermath of the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords, which brought to light Israel's deepening relations with the Arab and Muslim world in the face of an Iranian threat, Premier Netanyahu has seemingly started courting Israel's Arab 21% minority.
Idan Chadash matchil hayom.
Jerusalem's rapprochement with the Arab world has evidently granted Premier Netanyahu some aspired breakthrough, with a number of local Arab leaders boldly declaring their personal endorsements. Naturally, politicians from the Joint Arab List, which presents an alliance of Islamist, Communist, and Arab Nationalist parties, has viewed the Israeli Prime Minister's attempt as a deceptive maneuver to weaken the Arab sector's representation within the Israeli parliament.
Netanyahu is anti-Arab. Netanyahu is the problem. He is not the solution. He is attacking Arabs by a new electoral smile. He's smiling to Arabs these days. He's visiting Arab villages more than ever in the history.
Joint Arab List Chairperson Ahmed Tibi, who prior to his 1999 election to the Israeli parliament, or Knesset in Hebrew, served as a political advisor to the late Palestinian president Yasser Arafat, sought to shun the Arab leaders supporting Premier Netanyahu as individuals suffering from the Stockholm syndrome.
It's a joke. It's a joke, you know. Maybe it's Stockholm syndrome to have empathy with that person who kidnapped you or oppressed you. He will not have a lot of votes, even if he is more and more smiling and laughing. He wants less mandates for the joint list and less Arab who are going for turnout.
Per the latest poll, which questioned 505 respondents with a margin of error of 4.4%, Netanyahu's Likud is expected to garner 29 mandates if elections were held today, a drop of 7 from its 36 seats in parliament. The Likud is followed by Yesh Atid with 16 mandates, Gideon Sa'ar's New Hope with 13 mandates, followed by the Joint Arab List with 10, equal to that of Naftali Bennett's Yamina. The ultra-Orthodox parties, Shas and United Torah Judaism, are expected to attain 9 and 7 mandates respectively, Israel Beiteinu 6 mandates, while alternate Premier and Defense Minister Benny Gantz's Blue and White is expected to drop from its 33 seats today to merely 5 mandates, equal to both the Labor Party and Meretz, which continue to lose ground. And while the upcoming parliamentary elections in the Jewish state, which are a continuation of Jerusalem's political limbo, clearly reflect deep divides within Israeli society, the Arab population living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, under the rule of the Palestinian Authority and Islamist Hamas respectively, are trying to bring about intra-Palestinian reconciliation by preparing for elections of their own, the first in 15 years.
So it looks to me again as if we're at a stalemate, with Netanyahu having 29 votes according to most recent polls, and Benny Gantz only 5 votes, down from the 33 he had. personally, I think they need to come up with an alternative to either of them. I mean, Benny obviously has faded. He has not made an impact. Netanyahu's popularity is going down because you get tired of these people. There's fatigue with any politician, don't you think?
I don't think that, you know what, I mean, we say it every time, but I think, you know, quite frankly, when we look at the field in Israel, he's still the strongest candidate. He still has the most support. And so, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, look, I think what's most interesting is that you do have Arab members of the Knesset joining with him. And quite, I know we talked about this maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago on the air, because some of them are very frustrated with the other Arab, the other Arab members who joined the joint list, you know, feeling like you don't really care about what's happening in our communities in Israel. Like, you only care about fighting Israel and the whole Palestinian cause, instead of actually saying, hey, we're citizens of this country. We've got real issues happening in our neighborhood. We want to be a part of the discussion, and we want to be part of the majority here. So we do see this happening right now. It's interesting. Look, I mean, it's the same problem with having a peace negotiation. There's not like one person who speaks for the Palestinian people. I mean, Abbas, who is you know, considered by his own people in many respects to run a very corrupt government, you know, he can't speak for all the Palestinian people. The people in Gaza and the Hamas will say, you don't speak for us. I mean, the whole thing's so crazy. And now, you know, even though he was elected for 2 years, he's held that position for 15 years, you know, kind of like a dictator.
There hasn't been an election since 2006, right?
Yeah.
So how about the guy that is talking about running against him, that's serving 5 life sentences in an Israeli jail?
Barghouti, yes. So Barghouti, who is part of the Intifada, he led the movement. I mean, this is the guy who, you know, he's serving life sentences for responsibility for suicide bombings and shootings of Israeli citizens, who is known for saying just as recently as 2014, you know, Palestinians should support total resistance and the rifle. So he is considered a threat to Abbas. This is the
he's reality. In jail on 5 life sentences. I mean, that's just lunacy. It's absolute lunacy.
Be on the ticket, I don't know. But I do want to talk about this a little bit, because, you know, obviously we've been monitoring the Biden administration. Obviously we're very pleased with like the ambassador to the United Nations. There has been some rumblings about the fact that the Biden administration and President Biden has not yet spoken with, or has not yet called, Bibi Netanyahu. And I know his administration came back and said, oh, no, you shouldn't read anything into that. But I was more concerned, I would say, on Friday, or maybe it was yesterday, the 13th, the press secretary, she was asked, you know, does the administration consider Israel and Saudi Arabia on Port Allen.
Jen Psaki, right.
Right, and she didn't answer the question. She's like, oh, you know, we're still, in essence, you know, reviewing our national security approaches. And that, I was like, really?
Yeah, I thought that was a misstep as well. I thought that was a misstep as well. But the Biden administration says the fact they haven't reached out to Bibi is not a slight. And, you know, maybe they're figuring out who is going to be in charge of Israel. We don't know. Is it Bibi?
They chose, though. So they have this one guy. They made his name is Hadi Amir, or Arm. I'm going to say it's A-M-R. As Deputy Secretary of Palestine, and this guy, he's the one. He said he back in the early 2000s was inspired by the Palestinian Intifada. I mean, this guy is pretty radical. Not someone I would think I would want. Who accused Israel of apartheid. Not someone I think I'd want to be holding that role. So I'm not really sure why he was.
That was puzzling to me too. Listen, I'm going to take a quick left turn, because we need to. It's been a contentious show, which I like, but I found something. It's just about a minute piece today that I just loved. It's called "Speaking Torah to Power." And I just thought it was one of the more lovely things, because obviously as Jews, Torah is the ultimate guiding document for our faith. And this is a little piece I found, "Speaking Torah to Power." Mark, can we roll that?
I speak Torah to power.
I speak Torah to power.
I speak Torah to power.
I speak Torah to power by living an authentic life in my truth.
By knowing that I come from a lineage of strong, outspoken Jews.
To understand suffering and meet it with love.
I speak Torah to power to create change and to be sure that whatever work I do, its seeds and the ultimate plant that it grows is about justice.
I speak Torah to power by confronting the climate crisis with spiritual audacity and bold political action.
By continuing to show up in Jewish spaces when I'm often erased.
To improve our communities for all, with a focus on ending anti-Black racism and other forms of oppression.
I speak Torah to power by knowing that the boundaries that people have put up have been pushed down in the past, as long as we're here and that we have something to say about it.
I speak Torah to power by being unafraid to have an opinion when others are afraid to speak up.
And when I heard that, Laureen, I thought, hopefully that's our show, Outspoken Jews. And Lord knows we are.
Exactly. So you know, I going back to that big tech piece, did you see this one piece on IBM?
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. Edwin Black wrote it. We had Edwin Black on our show, more than a year ago. Yeah. He's written a whole book about IBM helping Hitler categorize where Jews were in Europe when Hitler came to power. And his defense, Edwin Black's defense, when we interviewed him, he talked a little bit about this, was that the book has been out there, I don't know how many years, but he says IBM has never sued him, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, yeah, he wrote the book 20 years ago.
Was it 20 years ago? Jeez.
Yeah, for those years, it's IBM and the Holocaust. And he sort of felt felt compelled to rewrite this op-ed piece on his book to, you know, say, look, this is no different. Like IBM knowingly organized all six phases of the Holocaust. And he's concerned because he sees how big tech really can be utilized. And by the way, Watson, according to him, you know, the CEO of IBM, he said he was a sociopath, and he pretty much was the one who reached out to the Third Reich and said, I can help you. And they did it through those punch cards, kind of like what they use for the census. So these punch cards, so obviously pre-computer days, but the punch cards with fast counters were great ways to tell all sorts of information about people, about their race, where they live, the number of people in their home, ages, et cetera, and was used and also used by the Third Reich for train schedules to the death camps and all kinds of things. And I think he felt like this was important to remind people just, you know, how powerful big tech can be, you know, and not to take this lightly. So I read that piece.
Maybe we ought to go back to our archives, not this week, but in the next week or two and pull that out. I think that is important and is very relevant today. So maybe we'll go back to our archives and see if we can dig that out. Because I thought he was a pretty interesting guy.
Very interesting. So, that piece in Poland this week, which was just so disappointing.
Oh, yeah. The lawsuit, the apology.
I mean, so you have these Holocaust scholars who wrote a book, you know, they're talking about, you know, specifically in Poland, you know, instances of people in Poland who really helped the Third Reich in sort of organizing, capturing the Jews, then sending them off to death camps. And I think it was a niece of one of them who was accused, sued the scholars, you know, for libel. The courts allowed the case to go forward, and these women had to, I think they had to pay something.
No, I think they wiped off the fine. There was a fine. I think they wiped it off, but they had to do a written apology to the niece. And basically what it's doing is Poland is trying to distance itself from its complicity in the Holocaust. And this is just another prime example of that. That's what that was all about. Poland wants to say, yeah, we had nothing to do with that, which we know that is not true.
I mean, so funny, right. I mean, I just was very frustrated by that this week. Very sad when we see these things happening over there. But there were some interesting things that happened this week. I mean, look, Morocco was telling that obviously wrote a letter to the Arab League this week, telling them that they should be embracing diplomacy with Israel, and that by doing this, it actually would help support peace with the Palestinians and help resolve the issue. So you see Morocco taking a very active role now. Now they have entered into normalization and the Abraham Accords.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing. Hey, listen, what we got to do, though, we got to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about the Israeli companies involved in the Super Bowl. Pretty interesting stuff. But let's take a quick break here.
We'll hear all about the Israeli companies involved in the Super Bowl in moments. But first, we want to talk just a minute about our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com. There you can comment on the podcast, make suggestions for future podcasts, and catch up on any Third Opinion you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
This is the Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Jaffe.
Okay, here is the interview we've been telling you about. There have been some Israeli companies that have breakout technology that was, they were all involved in sports issues and involved in the Super Bowl last week. Tell us a little bit about this, Loreen.
Yeah, so this is actually pretty exciting. So the Florida Israel Business Accelerator, along with the Israeli Business Coliseum, along with Israel and Miami and the Israeli Consulate, put together these speakers of five different businesses from Intel Sports, Texol, Sleep Rate, Pico, and I can't, the other one, forgive me, I think it's Ibar Tech, that all were involved behind the scenes one way or another with the Super Bowl. So from bringing the technologies, security, et cetera. So very exciting to see. And this really, you know, this to me also was just demonstrated the success FIBA, as well as Israel Miami, and all the work to bring Israeli companies here into Florida and ultimately the United States to bring their technologies here. So
I had a forum last week, and this and this is part of, now there's some little accents with some of these. I want to warn you, some of them are a little clearer than others, but it's so fascinating. They're talking about sleep and athletic performance and all. And why don't we roll that? I think you'll find this interesting.
I'll start by asking you to share 30 seconds or something like that about your journey and about your initiative. So I'll take the lead with asking Valin from Sleep Rate, 30 seconds about Sleep Rate. Always good to be first. Please, Valin.
So please time me and stop me when you need. So Sleep Rate provides affordable and scalable digital sleep solutions. Sleep Rate started off in the medical device software segment and turned to the consumer world around 2013. Around that time, while we took our technology of sleep measurement and sleep solutions into the consumer world, we understood the needs of athletes for sleep solutions. And in 2014, actually, we started working with the Team USA, helping them prepare to the Rio Olympics.
Espera un poco. We'll tap into that. We'll tap into that, okay. Darlene. I'm jumping.
Okay. And that's how we ended up having a dedicated solution for sports. And I pass the mic back to you.
Amazing. Thank you, Valin. So with that, I'll jump to Costa. Costa, please.
Hello. I'm a neuroscientist and entrepreneur.
Costa, you look like. You don't need to say that.
And we founded iBrain because we wanted to allow athletes to improve their performance by directly training the most important organ, the brain. Thank you.
Amazing. Okay, Eran?
Yes, hi. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for inviting us for having this show today. Texel was founded in late 2016 by two veterans from the video technology industry in Israel, Amir Segev and Guy Zisman, basically targeting to find creative ways how to increase the engagements of users when they consume OTT services to enable them basically to customize the different views to get social feeds while watching the content, the live events also. And in parallel to that, to add another layer of social engagements. I think the term in North America is like watch party from Netflix. So on the same concept, but increase that also to add video, like what we're doing right now, to follow commentators that will interpret the game and tell it in their words, whether they are in English or Spanish or Japanese or whatever.
Amazing. You took it all. Amazing. Thank you, Eran. And jumping to Asaf.
Hi. My name is Asaf, and I am CEO and co-founder at Pico. Pico is a data-driven fan marketing platform. We are a SaaS platform that helps sports teams to really gather first-party data about their fans. Surprisingly, the bigger the club is, the less they know about their fans. And Pico's mission is to help them build a real database about who they are, what they like, what they don't, how can you market better to them, how could you make a more personalized experience with them. Currently working with more than 60 professional sports teams around the globe with customers in Europe, United States, Asia, many NFL teams, NBA, NHL teams, and yeah, operating from Israel and an office in the United States.
We have a few interesting questions towards your growth, Asaf, and how the last year impacted the company, and we'll tap into it soon. So Dana, jumping to you.
Hi, so I'm representing Intel Sports, which is a little different, I think, than the other startups that we were talking here. However, Intel Sports was created out of an acquisition of a few startup companies, one of them being an Israeli startup. A lot of our R&D is still in Israel, and the idea was really to create new and immersive experiences for fans and how they participate in the game and how they watch the game, and to really just create new experiences different than the regular broadcasts that we're used to seeing, which I will expand on further. However, with the use of Intel and through that acquisition, we've really been able to kind of harness the Intel mothership and Intel Corporation in terms of the technology and the power that Intel can provide. However, as Intel Sports, we still operate as a small business group. So we like to call ourselves a little startup within the big mothership of Intel Corporation.
Absolutely, absolutely. So Dana, to continue with you, and we passed one slide, we drew you Intel logo, and I will jump into my first question for the panel. So for you, Dana, how does the TrueView technology and what is the TrueView technology is actually changing the viewing experience? We just saw a camera, if you can tell a bit more about it.
Yeah, so Intel TrueView is really the name of the product that we provide to the NFL amongst other partners that we work with. And you'll be able to see some of that in the upcoming game on Sunday. The idea is really to create immersive experiences. So we're all used to kind of watching the game, and this hasn't changed probably in the last 30 years. You have high cameras, you have some low cameras, you know, last few years you have a Skycam to show you what that broadcast looked like. What we do is we install dozens of cameras and we create a 3D scene out of the real game. However, it's real. It's real play and it's not an animation of what it is. So what we do is we actually create virtual cameras and the fan can place himself anywhere on the field. So if you want to see what did Tom Brady see when he threw the ball, you know, what was his defense look like, what receiver was open, why did he throw it this or that way, you can actually place yourself from his perspective and experience that game from there. Or on the other side, you know, Patrick Mahomes, why is he running versus passing? The viewer can choose where they want to be on the field of play during different game times. And so think about it in terms of when you play video games, if you're doing Madden, right, you can create that virtual view. However, this is real time. So through the technology, what we do is we create from a 2D, we create a 3D scene. So from 2D, we add the voxels into and add that scene. And then the fan can actually choose where he wants to see the game from which perspective. And so we call those immersive experiences. So you're really seeing the game from a different perspective. And I think, Oren, you talked about the Fluid Fans, which we're huge fans of the Fluid Fans, because we really believe that this is the future of what broadcasting will be and how fans will experience the game, not the traditional way, but actually immersing yourself inside that experience.
Yeah, that sounds great. And it's an opportunity to give the credit to Angela Romero, which is, a well-known Olympic NHL athlete, medalist, and so on, that developed the Fluid Fan concept. Thank you for that, Dana, and truly disruptive. And we are waiting to see that. I actually experienced the product This is disruption. Jumping to USF, we know the situation around stadiums. They're empty, or at least the Super Bowl 2/3 empty. How do you see the engagement and the experience of fans today when stadiums are empty from a point of view of watching the game, but also experience the engagement with the game?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, first of all, I think engagement, like you said before, like Sportech, engagement is also a very wide word. One of the things we're seeing that teams finally realize that, you know, now that fans can come to teams and teams have to come to fans, they need to really start leveraging the fact that they have lots of really high traffic digital assets and start to think more like the Amazon and Facebook and Google of the world. Finally, they're starting to realize that and they understand the importance of visual digital personalization, really getting to know who the fans are, what they want. Like Dana said, what angle do you want to see the game at? What type of content you're actually interested at? What type of offers could be relevant for you? And so on. And we're seeing that because there is no attendance and because most of the data for teams used to come from people who are inside the stadiums and kind of like fans like ourselves, like in Israel, when you're far away from most of the bigger markets, we were completely unknown. And now when they start to realize that there's many fans that are sitting in smaller markets, they're starting to actually make efforts to make us happy because we're also fan fluid, as you mentioned, but we're fans. And Narzo spending a lot on leveraging and capitalize on these opportunities, you know, like everybody else in COVID, and joining the digital engagement to really drive new business.
Amazing. I see some questions arising on the chat. We'll tap into them quite soon. Thank you for that, Asaf. And jumping from the engagement with the fans to the engagement with the athletes, Valim, at SleepRage, we have a lot of engagement with top athletes, elite athletes. Some of them are from the US team and other sports organization. What did you learn about your users during this year?
So this year we were helping a lot of our users, the Olympic users, preparing for Tokyo, what's supposed to be Tokyo 2020. And while COVID hit, athletes experienced a lot of emotional roller coaster, career insecurity, and training facilities shutting down. And we were actually expecting them to, with anxiety and depression and so on, to have less engagement and less usage of the system. But what we actually saw, that using the system actually helped them maintain their scheduling, their lifestyle, which was very challenging during this time. And the usage was actually increased by the athletes. So that was really actually a surprise in SleepRate in terms of this year and the way that our users engage with the system.
Interesting. So Costa, we know that the sports industry is divided into two main industries. So we talk about performance in media and performance, athlete performance. Yeah, let's divide it into those two main areas. So if we tap into Pico and Intel, so we are trying to enhance and improve the way we experience from the media point of view. Yeah. Valin and yourself, you're more on the side of the athlete development. So it's a rapidly growing sector in the sports tech industry that includes a lot of technologies that related to athletic performance. Can you please shed a light on the novel technologies in this sector from your point of view, especially coming with the background, the academic background?
Pleasure. Thank you. I would say that in the field of athlete performance technology, we can name like wearables, smart equipment, tracking tools, injury prevention, and rehab technologies. That five I would identify. And these tools are intended to improve the physical performance of athletes. And this space evolved tremendously over time with data, enabling more informed decision-making. So data is, in my opinion, the main factor for technology evolution, and it is in line with the global technological trend in most of the industries, right? But what I would add here in sports, in my opinion, we have specific disruptive trends. And until now, the majority of training has been focused on physical body. Nowadays, modern sports science research show that success in sports is mostly explained by non-physical factors, such as brain functions, mental readiness, resilience. There are emerging technologies for sleep monitoring, sports psychology, and brain training. Because at the end of the day, our brain controls both our decisions and movements, and therefore it's equally as important to monitor and train the brain as it is to monitor and train physical bodies. And to summarize, I believe that data-driven technologies for all aspects of athletes' performance have the potential to dramatically change the sector, and this process has started around a decade ago.
Amazing. Thank you for that, Eran. Don't sleep over there. If you sleep, we monitor you and we need you awake. So tapping into Techcell as a rising star startup like the others we have here, tell me a little bit about your environment today and the OTT environment, and then I will ask you about amplifying with the user engagement. But first of all, share with us a little bit about the industry, about OTT, and how do you see it?
Okay, so basically, I think everybody is aware about the trend of companies, content owners, that they shift from regular broadcasting via satellite or cables into the OTT space. This is one trend that we are aware of. And the second trend is that those content owners are going directly to consumers, which open basically huge opportunities for them to understand and know their customers. And we see challenges of where we believe our technology can provide. And again, Techcell is a B2B company. We are providing an SDK to support these OTT vendors. And the three of the major problems that we are helping or trying to support those OTT brands is how to increase the engagement for them of going directly to their users. And what are the three challenges or three engagements that we are helping them to improve? The first one is how to increase, how can they basically enable their viewers to increase and see more from the same content rather than to see it by themselves. And I will talk about it in a second. The second part is how to expand their using of viewers' habit. Let's say I'm going to see the Super Bowl, which is fine, but maybe because me and Oren are going to see a basketball game, then Dana will join us because we are a small party and she has a loyalty for our party, for our friends, like we are doing on a daily basis before the COVID. And the third part is basically how to expand the users' demographics of the viewers to their friends. Think about it that we're watching a game together, and within one click, I can invite someone to press and join us together, enjoying the same content.
It is amazing how the technology has changed everything in sports. And happily, there are a lot of Israeli companies that are at the forefront of it. While we might have a thin roster of NFL players that are Jewish, we are certainly involved in all aspects of sports from the other side, from the metrics in baseball that the Rays use all the time, with a lot of Israeli companies and Israeli-based folks. It's come a long way, Laureen.
By the way, my favorite is Intel Sport. I mean, when you can go down on the field and feel like you've got this four-dimensional view and see really what the players are seeing. I mean, the way technology is coming, and I remember they used similar technology in the Olympics from an Israeli startup, for the first time there, that did something similar. It gives us this ability to really feel like we're there, that we're a player. We can see what they see. It's a whole new way of watching the game. And
a lot of Israeli companies are right there bringing it to us. So it makes you sort of proud,
Very exciting. Yeah. So, by the way, but on COVID news, we should mention this week. So Israel and Greece are reopening travel lines between the two of them for those who have gotten the vaccine. They don't have mandatory quarantine times, but also exciting, that we talked about this drug, I think, last week, Mike, that Israel, some of the scientists there had come up with, that 29 out of 30 people who had been in the hospital within days were much better and then were able to go home. So 29 out of 30 coronavirus patients were cured with this drug, EXO-CD24. It's obviously still in the regulatory stages, and they're going to be doing clinical trials, but Bibi Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, was with, I believe it was the Prime Minister from Greece.
From Greece, yeah, he was, and he was showing him. He said it smells like what, seawater, saltwater, seawater, something like that.
It's really, apparently you inhale it, and apparently it's had, as we said, with at least some of the testing that's been happening in Israel, tremendous response. I mean, look, we now have a vaccine, right, around the world. There are multiple drug companies with vaccines, but this seems to be maybe the first drug as far as curing people who have it, who have COVID, who are in the hospital, who otherwise, you know, would have been on a ventilator and potentially would have died. This is something that apparently is breakthrough for treating patients. So very exciting to see this breakthrough happening, and hopefully that will move forward speedily for those who need the help. But really excited to see this news going on.
I want to get your take on this. I have no idea what it is, but I don't know if you saw the article. I think I sent it to you, that now that Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador, has come out against Trump and the Republican Party, the Times of Israel, one of them said that they thought Nikki Haley would be the darling of the Jewish people who had supported Trump, or the Republicans, let's put it that way, for the nomination in 2024. What's your take?
Yeah, you know, I read what she said. I mean, I've always loved Nikki. I think she is a force of nature. I thought she was probably our most powerful ambassador ever to the UN.
More than Shirley Temple?
Okay. And so, I'm a Nikki Haley fan.
She spoke at that APEC conference that I covered and you were part of a couple of years ago. And she was very impressive. Yeah.
Standing ovation that went on forever. And I think, you know, look, she separated herself from Trump on one issue. But she didn't, you know, fully criticize him. I mean, I think she.
Yes, she did. She said the party cannot be the party of Trump anymore. It's got to move on. That was her statement this week. And that's why.
Yeah. I mean, I get what she's saying there, but at the same time, she also was, you know, she was very supportive of Trump throughout the administration.
She was. And she got some criticism from some people who had liked her beforehand and her stance in South Carolina. I just wondered what your thought was for 2024.
Forward to 2024. I think there's a lot of players out there that are trying to position themselves to run for office. I don't think Trump has any interest in running for office again.
I think you're right. I think he's going to dangle it, but I don't think he's going to do anything.
I think she's trying to separate herself from the pack of others, you know.
Well, her stance on Israel and the UN, I think, all of a sudden makes her rise among some segments of the Jewish population. She was obviously very, very supportive of Israel.
Yeah, look, and she was a really good, if you all remember, I mean, she, first of all, she's an Indian American. She is, her parents came here, they were immigrants. If we remember our current vice president, she's both Black American as well as Indian American.
And female.
And Nikki Haley is Indian American.
Lorene, you hear that music? Do you know what that means? We are out of time. This is the third opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast for this week. Subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.